Well, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'd like to give two lectures on work that we have been doing in Valdivia with Andrés Gomberov, Marc Henault, Frank Wilczek on the thermal decay of the cosmological constant into black holes. The whole content of the talks will be within what John Wheeler used to call battle-tested, old-fashioned general relativity. All the calculations or concepts that will be used will be within the semi-classical approximation. So that means that if the theory is embedded into a more fundamental theory, they have a chance, they should have a chance to survive future developments. There will be also some string smell to it at the most, because it will deal with extended objects, but that's about it. So, and this is the end of the apologies in regard to the title of the meeting. The problem at hand is, of course, the problem that you well know. The absence or the almost absence of the cosmological term is one of the biggest defeats of theoretical physics. There is a discrepancy of 160 if one is kind and uses a supersymmetry scale, or 120 is one if less kind and uses a Planck scale for a cutoff of between orders of magnitude between theory and experiment. Not ever in the history of physics, I think, theoreticians have been in such a bad shape. So the so-called problem of the cosmological constant is the problem of accounting for its zero, one used to say, or it's become fashionable to say very small value at the present time. Now, there is, there one might have two. Since we are in football championships, or soccer, as one says elsewhere, I claim 10 minutes of time, because we started 10 minutes late. There are two automatic reactions to this, and I have had, and I think many of my colleagues also, both of them as time goes by. One is to find some fundamental principle, like a gauge principle of some sort, that would show that the cosmological constant must be zero. That would be less favored now, because sometimes there are news saying that it may not be exactly zero. And the other way of approaching this is to look for something that is, in a sense, dearer to a physicist that likes to look into details of things, which is to look for a mechanism, something that might maybe start with a cosmological constant which is not zero, and then, due to the mechanism, make it decay into zero during the history of the universe. Those mechanisms have been studied by several people during the years, and it's what that is the context in which I'd like to speak. Since the cosmological term may be thought of as the energy of the vacuum, then any such mechanism would be, in one form or another, a mechanism where the universe would go from, as I think Sidney Coleman maybe was the first to use the term, would go from a false vacuum into a true vacuum. Now, one such mechanism, which is the one that we have been looking at, and I like it, and many people do, or some people do, is through the spontaneous nucleation of a membrane. Oh, I will indulge as Jose Edelstein told me that Frank Wilczek always gets some kind of a smile from the audience if he apologizes for talking about four space-time dimensions. So I will do the same. So I will be discussing four space-time dimensions. So you can change the numbers of the dimensions of the surfaces as time. It doesn't matter. But in four space-time dimensions, one would nucleate a two-dimensional membrane in space whose history is three-dimensional. The membrane would be, in this approach, a fundamental object, not a thick filled membrane, but just a fundamental object, much like the membranes that you all love. And it would divide space-time in two regions. One region that we would call the minus region, which is the interior, and another region called the plus region. This is for later notation, which is the exterior. And the membrane will be endowed with a charge, which is the gauge charge of a three-index antisymmetric gauge potential, and the cosmological constant, or rather its square root, would jump going from the inside of the membrane to the outside by one unit of charge. Now, this process would occur once, and then again, many times, hopefully enough times during the history of the universe to account for the present small value of the cosmological constant. That's old. That's a very old story. That approach dates back more than 20 years. And so that's not exactly what I want to report about now, but rather a modification of that, which is what we have been doing recently. And to introduce the concepts and to be, or at least try to make you be as amazed as I am with the endless surprises that one gets from battle-tested general relativity, I will go to the simplest case, which is, first of all, two-dimensional space-time, not even four. And then, perhaps at the end of this lecture, go into four, or if I don't have enough time, in the next lecture. So I'd like to, first of all, summarize for you things which are well known about instability, because what we are talking is about an instability. It's a space with a cosmological term that is in an unstable configuration and wants to go down into another one, which is hopefully more stable, and keep doing that. Now, there is a whole theory of that, and the standard example, if I can find the transparency, is the example of a one-dimensional potential. Is that focused, or I cannot see with these glasses?
Not very well.
Not very well. The focus lock in, this is too advanced for me. Well, it's a potential anyway. How do we focus this thing? Focus lock, it says.
I think you need to zoom it.
Zoom it. Thank you. Zoom in. Ah, fantastic. Okay, well, that's it. Even if it were not focused, you could see it. So, all right, so let's think quickly of one-dimensional quantum mechanics. This hopefully is the real potential, namely the potential in what field theorists would call Lorentzian space-time. The other one will have to flip the transparency. So there is the false vacuum. There is what people call the true vacuum. And the particle, in this case, wants to go from here to there. Now, it can do this in two different ways. It can tunnel through the barrier. The sophisticated mechanism through which it does that is associated with the name, the term instanton. So it's here, it tunnels, and then goes to through vacuum. That is, one would say, a strictly quantum mechanical phenomenon, because we are talking about a particle with zero energy or very small energy near the bottom of this potential well, maybe in the ground state of this approximate oscillator. The bound state is unstable, it's an approximately bound state, not truly a bound state, and then it will tunnel and go through. This mechanism, or the analog of that mechanism, was studied many years ago by Sidney Coleman, by Kurt Callan, and other people as well. Before them, I think, Okun. And the paper had a nice title. It was called The Fate of the False Vacuum, and we all enjoyed it when we were young, some of us. So, but there is another way for the particle to go from the false vacuum to the true vacuum, and it's really the other way, the one we will be dealing with. The other way is to put this in a thermal bath. If one puts this in a thermal bath, the particle will get a thermal kick once in a while with a probability e to the minus beta e, the Boltzmann factor. If the thermal kick is big enough, the particle may be popped up to here and can easily go to the other side without even knowing quantum mechanics. It can do it classically. Of course, one doesn't want to give it too much of an energy to make it too easy, because then the probability becomes very low, because the Boltzmann factor becomes very small, because it's e to the minus beta e. So the compromise is to just give it enough energy so that it is at the top of the barrier. When it is at the top of the barrier, there is a classical solution of the equations of motion where the particle simply sits there forever. It's a static, unstable solution of the classical equations. Now, there is a general theory of metastability. It's beautiful, and I'm so grateful I had to, I wouldn't say learn it, but at least be aware of it, trying to work on this subject. There is a great paper by Langer in 69. There is a beautiful paper by Affleck in 81. And there are also several works by Linde. And the references I already spoke about on tunneling are these. And I just added here, for the record, David Brown and I are using these tunneling ideas, worked along the lines I've just discussed in 87 or so, But that's not the thermal phenomenon, which is what I will focus on today. Now, just as it is for the instanton, the formalism of thermal metastability is also based on the Euclidean continuation of the theory. Both of them are, of course, the classical metastability one could do maybe without, but one can do semi-classical metastability, and then the Euclidean potential comes in, which is the same potential, oops, I have drawn, but as you all know, upside down. So in the classical time, and from now on, I will, I think, only write Euclidean equations and drop the subscript E. So for the solution corresponding to tunneling, the particle in Euclidean time oscillates in here, and for that solution that has to do with metastability, which is a thermal effect, the solution sits now at the top of the Euclidean potential. I hope I didn't say this backwards. It's supposed to be classically, no, it's, I said it backwards because the potential is like that. Yeah, it's backwards. So it's classically, the solution is unstable, is unstable in the Lorentzian regime and is stable in the Euclidean regime. Now, I have a table comparing the properties. Now I have to zoom the other way. It's impossible to unzoom. Out, it says. Jesus Christ, I worked hard on this thing. No, no, but wait. It has something that one... Ah. And then... And the focus, I have no idea. Well, can you read something of this? Well, anyway. Zoom a little more. No, that's the other way. There, roughly, I can. I was so proud of this table. Jesus Christ. It has inertia of its own. All right, let's see if we get it right. One should not read tables, so you read it. But anyway, here there is an attempt of a summary. We have coined a name to emphasize the thermal, the underlying thermal concept in the static solution. We have called it a thermalon. I think that this was called before in particle physics, sphaleron. The thermalon, since it is unstable, when you perturb it, it falls half of the time to one side and half of the time to the other side of the barrier. If for a moment I jump ahead, and this will be related to the cosmological term, this means that in the case of the cosmological constant, the thermalon, this particle, will be the membrane I was talking about. So in one case, it will, so to speak, advanced toward the exterior and in the other case it will advance toward the interior. When it advances toward the interior, it will do nothing, because after it contracts, everything will be left as before. But the other half of the cases, which is a lot, this half, it will change the world. So here I'll just, this is the key thing that we need to use later on. The instanton in both cases, both at zero temperature and at non-zero temperature either, is something that goes through the potential barrier. The thermalon goes over it by a thermal kick. The key feature of the instanton solution is that it depends on time. And the key feature of the thermalon is that it's time independent. Which solution dominates which? Well, it's written there. For the inverse temperature near zero, we have the instanton. I think there is a minus one missing everywhere. Because we want low temperature. There may be a minus one. But since we're not going to use it, it doesn't matter. Now, there is a region at which both kinds of solution overlap. And here, there is a new parameter which comes in, and which is the frequency of oscillation of the in Euclidean time. You see, in Euclidean time, the thermalon is stable because it is unstable in Lorentzian time. So in Euclidean time, it has a frequency of oscillation. It is assumed in all this work, and that's why I was asking early on in the lecture of Gary Gibbons, what would he do if he had more than one negative mode? Because we found several negative modes in four dimensions. But in the normal state of things, there is only one negative and one instability mode. And this omega here is the frequency of the instability mode. So there is, if one starts at a very low temperature, then the instanton dominates. When it keeps raising the temperature, there is an overlap region where both the instanton and the thermalon compete, and then one goes up with the temperature. One goes up with beta E, and then the thermalon dominates. We will be interested in the region in which the thermalon dominates. Now, the formulas, which are the formulas for the decay rate, although they come from different sides of physics, they are amazingly similar. The formula for the decay rate is always related to the imaginary part of the free energy. The free energy has an imaginary part because one approximates a functional integral with a saddle point, and there is this unstable mode. So at zero temperature, it's just, as we all know, one wants the instanton to exist at zero temperature. We all do that. So it's, I think there is a beta to the minus, there is a minus one missing in several places. So the formula for the decay rate has the imaginary part of the free energy. For the instanton, it has a factor 2 over h bar. And for the thermalon, it has the inverse temperature, and it has the frequency of this oscillation mode. This formula was proved by Langer and then very beautifully elaborated on by Ian Affleck. And so, and there is, of course, an overlap region where these two factors are comparable, which is explained here. When beta h bar is of the order of 2 pi over omega, in general, both solutions will compete. Speak up.
Is it right quantum tunneling depends on both the height and width of the barrier, whereas the classical tunneling depends on only the height of the barrier?
No, no. If you calculate it, because this omega has to do with the second derivative of the, so it has to do also with the shape of the barrier, but maybe less sensitive than the tunneling.
So the f in the two cases are
is the same f.
Is f at the top of the barrier?
No, f is f. I mean, f is the free energy. F, in principle, you compute by a path integral in Euclidean time, summing over all histories. Now we approximate it in the semi-classical or the steepest descent approximation by one particular solution and around it. In the case of the thermalon, it's that one at the top of the barrier. In the other case, it's the so-called bounce or whatever by the typical thermalon.
But I missed where the action of that bounce appeared in your formula.
Oh, because beta F is the action.
I'm sorry, but I mean, a system could have finite free energy even though it has zero tunneling rate if you make that barrier infinitely broad.
It's a sub. You have an X for the dimension.
No, just
on the field theory.
No, it just make the direct in the direction of the tunneling, you make the finite height but very broad.
Yes, this is the imaginary part. It's because the thing is unstable. Is that all right now?
No, maybe I missed.
No, but if, I don't know. I mean, the system has well-defined free energy about the minimum. It says free energy is something real.
No. The free energy is not real because the state is unstable.
But, I mean, the whole system has a vacuum. So it has well-defined free energy. So then, if that F has an imaginary part, it's not really the free energy. It's some false thing. Some free energy around the false minimum.
No, we are computing the free energy. We are computing. Let me just try to say it in another way. There are integrals over the real axis that give you an imaginary answer. This is a well-known phenomenon.
I suppose I just don't understand what that F is in your formula.
You have to take into account the fluctuation around the mean, the maximum, the relative maximum. Fluctuation gives this oscillator modes, so you have an imaginary contribution because you have modes which are negative, eigenvalues are negative.
So should I think of F as being the log of the path integral around the instanton?
Not around the, well, in one case around the instanton, in the other case around the thermalon, yes.
Yes, okay. But that's different from the free energy of the system.
Oh. Fine, if that makes you happy, that's fine. I would say that the free energy has an imaginary part, but that's... I mean, it's the same discussion as whether the energy of an unstable state is real or imaginary. I mean, the energy of a particle which is about to decay into two has an imaginary part, which is the decay rate. It's just that. Okay, now, Jesus, I better hurry up. All right, now there is the simplest analog of the phenomenon that I want to discuss occurs in 1 plus 1 space-time dimensions. The analog is very old and very well known. It is the example of the creation of a pair in an external field. We can dispense with the business of external field later on, but I just want to keep it simple. If you have a pair in an external field, then, I mean, if you have an external field, then all of a sudden a pair will pop out. If we are in 1 plus 1 space dimensions, this is the exact analog of a, I mean, the vector potential is the exact analog of a three-form in four dimensions. The pair will divide space into two regions, the region inside the pair, where the field will be lowered by an amount equal to the charge of each particle of the pair, and the field outside the pair will be the field that there was before the pair was created. Then this pair will fly away, and the region where the electric field is lower will increase and increase and increase. That phenomenon normally in Minkowski space is considered to be an instanton. I will put here what Gary Gibbons would call a cartoon, but this is well drawn. This cartoon. So he had only the bottom part of the cartoon, because then he had Lorentzian space here, so these were hyperbolas. So one says the usual words. One says this is localized in space-time, this is why it's called an instanton and all that. So that's the trajectory. The trajectory is clearly time-dependent, because it's going around in time. I mean, the time here is zero, then at time whatever, it's not at the same place, it's turning around. So this is the classical example, the simplest example of an instanton. It can be recast, although nobody does it, but for us it was useful to do it. It can be recast in terms of a potential. If one is dumb and one wants to do things the hard way, one can write the equations of motion in terms of the coordinate time t. Nobody in his right relativistic mind would do that, but we did it anyway. And then one can even work it out so that the system looks as if it were a non-relativistic system moving in this funny sort of potential. So the particle will start here, will go down, 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 down a lot. It will come back up, and then it will go down again and come back up, and that would be the full circle that you saw in the other picture. So this would be the potential that is used for the instanton. Now the fun is the following, and I apologize for having spent most of the time telling things that either you already knew or you knew better than I do. But we now do something which is the following. We pass, and I should have a blank transparency to write this. We pass to polar coordinates. I just want to use the same conventions for the factors. So we are going to pass, so this T was the original Euclidean time, and we pass to polar coordinates like this, where L is some arbitrary length, and we do this. All right? This, of course, is the Euclidean version of Rindler coordinates. And we can now, this is just a simple change of coordinates, we can reanalyze the problem in polar coordinates. Of course, this thing, once it is looked at in polar coordinates, if I could find again the cartoon, but since it is a circle of fixed radius, it's time independent. And many of us learned this kind of thing through the Wundt effect and other things. It's a pleasure to find it again. If we analyze the problem and force it to force the analogy as a problem that is that of a particle moving in a potential, we find this time a potential of this sort. I'm trying to hide the caption because, well, it's even good. Let's leave the caption in. Now, there is nothing, if you like, paradoxical. The potential changes because the observer has changed, the time coordinate being used is different, but it's still the same motion. However, this time, the solution that we were calling before an instanton, and it had to do with barrier penetration, is now no longer an instanton, but it is a thermalon. This we actually realized only very recently, and we realized that this is we, hopefully, as we should have presented all of this to begin with. So you are being guinea pigs now. I don't know if it works. But if you remember the table which I had, in the table there was a range 2 pi over omega, where the instanton dominated, and there was a range, the other range, where the thermalon was of importance. Now, you will not be surprised, but to me it's a great delight to see that, you see, in this case, the overlap region has only one solution because there is only one solution, which is the same one looked at from two different coordinate systems. So, but it's a pleasure to check it. It so happens that if you calculate the frequency of oscillation, it turns out to be equal to 2 pi over omega. So we have, to me, a very striking example of this feature that we have learned, or we have been taught again and again over the last decades, I guess, namely that if one wants to join general relativity with quantum mechanics, one has to go through thermodynamics. Because the two ways of calculating this decay rate are so conceptually different. One is an entirely classical calculation, and the other is a strictly quantum mechanical tunneling. You go from one to the other by changing the coordinates, And of course, the answers are the same, but the conceptual baggage underlying them is very, very different. And so this is, to me, in the frontier between the sublime and the obvious, as somebody could say. But I find it quite remarkable. One can, I will not bother you with the details, but one computes the Boltzmann factor. One computes the temperature. Of course, the temperature here is the one corresponding to the polar coordinates not having a cusp. The scale L, which was introduced to go to the polar coordinates, drops out from the answer, as one should have expected, because it was not present in the other way of doing things. But so what the message so far is that already in two dimensions, these static solutions corresponding to thermal decay are already present. And one can couple this to some form of two-dimensional gravity. One can do everything. I will not show it to you. One can take into account the back reaction. One has two spheres instead of a plane, and everything works fine. One can compute not only the action, which is the exponential in the decay rate, but also the prefactor, and both the action and the prefactor come out to be identical, either if computed looking at the solution as an instanton or looking at the solution as a thermalon. So that's one plus one dimensions. Now, the next point does not have an analog in one plus one dimensions and is the following. We are going to discuss a positive cosmological constant, presumably at the beginning or early in the history of the universe, very large. It is standard to assume in this kind of model that the positive cosmological constant has two components. One is a large negative component coming, as one says, from the rest of physics, and the other is a bigger, a positive component coming from the three-index tensor, so the Lagrangian is whatever it is. And this lambda is something like this from the rest of physics. Plus f mu nu squared with the right sign and so on. So this is positive f mu nu rho sigma squared. And so the idea is that then this f mu nu rho sigma will be decayed, will be diminished because these membranes get formed and do the same as the pairs did in one plus one dimension. Now, this was studied a long time ago, and the newer thing that I'd like to mention is the following. If one has a Schwarzschild de Sitter space, and therefore one has two horizons, I will try to say this first in words and then show you the key equation and then analyze that in the next lecture. But let me try to get the main point across. if one has these two horizons, the following phenomenon happens. First of all, one can show that these thermalons exist. There are solutions of the coupled system of a three-form field of a two-dimensional membrane whose history has three dimensions, of the gravitational field, and I guess that's it, that are in which the, well, that are static, in which the membrane sits at a given point. These solutions we can find in a Schwarzschild de Sitter space, and there are two of them for a Schwarzschild de Sitter space, one that we call the black hole thermalon, and one that we call the cosmological thermalon. If perturbed, each of them half of the time will go one way and half of the time will go the other way. For example, the black hole thermalon, which will be a membrane that pops out outside the horizon, will half of the time run away from the black hole horizon and go towards the cosmological horizon and leave behind it a smaller cosmological term. That one is relatively analogous to the normal instanton that we studied in the past, and it faces the same problems that the instanton faced. Those problems, one of them was called the horizon problem, because if the space-time is expanding, the membrane cannot catch up with the expansion of the universe, and then it never decreases the cosmological constant in the whole of the universe. But it's there. The other thermalon that we would call the cosmological thermalon has the properties reversed. Namely, it forms at a radius less than that of the cosmological horizon, and then it proceeds, as one would normally say physically, to contract. It contracts if there was a black hole present at the beginning. It increases the mass of the black hole that was there at the beginning. But most interestingly, it even exists if there was no black hole at the beginning. So if there was only the Sitter space at the beginning, that still exists and still forms. And the end point is that it collapses into a black hole. So the process now does two things. One starts with a cosmological constant in the Sitter space, and one ends with a cosmological constant which has diminished in value and with a black hole. This we like a lot because it has a nice ring to it. It not only lowers the cosmological term, but it also gives a use for the energy and somehow transmutes an energy that was uniformly spread into an energy that is localized. And this beautiful battle-tested theory, that's the only thing that the poor theory can do with so few elements. It takes this vacuum energy and it produces matter out of it, localized matter. What kind of matter? Well, the only thing that it can do, black holes. What else would the poor theory do? I mean, it doesn't have automobiles or things to produce. So I would like to add one concept and then stop and ask for questions. I'm going to the technicalities next time. And the concept, or one comment, the comment is the following, and that for us, this analysis has permitted us to come to peace with something that appears to have been a problem to people for a long time, which is the following. People say, if one has a Schwarzschild, the Sitter black hole, the periodicity necessary to eliminate the conical singularity at the black hole horizon is not the same as the one needed to eliminate the cusp at the cosmological horizon. And this, for some reason, maybe not, but my perception is that for some reason that has been considered to be a difficulty. And again, the poor theory is doing the only thing that it can do for you, because when one is in asymptotically flat space, for example, how does one calculate a partition function or a path integral? One fixes a few things. For example, if one were doing the partition function for a black hole, one would fix the mass at infinity in one kind of an ensemble, or one would fix the temperature at infinity. But something would be fixed at infinity, and then one would sum over everything subject to those things being fixed at infinity. Now, infinity in that case, of course, is the limit of a very large sphere, and it is a boundary. And a boundary is a place where one is not supposed to ask the questions of motion to hold. One doesn't do this, because that's what boundaries are for, are places where one prescribes things, and then the questions of motion one don't hold there. So in the case of Schwarzschild the Sitter, we need a place where we can, if we are analyzing the thermodynamics, and this we had to do in the case of the thermalons, because if we were analyzing the properties, for example, of one of the two thermalons, say the black hole thermalon, we would need one place where we fix the things which will become the arguments of the partition function. So for one of the thermalons, we will happily remove a point in the sphere, and it doesn't matter that there is a conical singularity there, because one is not supposed to demand the questions of motion to hold there. There is simply the place analogous to infinity where things are held fixed. And similarly, in the other way. So for example, if one takes Schwarzschild the Sitter space, and one wants to analyze the thermal properties of the black hole horizon in the semi-classical approximation, one calculates, one knows from general grounds that the entropy is 1/4 of the area of the black hole. One calculates what the mass is. There is a thermodynamical formula. And the mass results to be m, the parameter m, which appears in the Schwarzschild the Sitter metric. If one studies, and then there is no conical singularity on the black hole, but there is a conical singularity on the cosmological horizon, because that's the analog of infinity. One can do it backwards. One can say, well, I'd like to study the thermodynamics of the cosmological horizon, then one would do the same, allowing for a conical singularity on the black hole horizon. And if one does this, one comes with an interesting result. One comes with the result that the internal energy of the cosmological horizon is not m, but is minus m. And this is perfectly consistent. And that I just wanted to mention in a general context before going into the details next time, because once one understands that, one can see well that both of the thermalons are unstable modes and that the potential for one is inverted with respect to the potential of the others, and many things simplify. So the two fun things which I have learned so far about this is that there were thermalons already in two dimensions, and for some reason we never saw them before, at least not in this way. And second, that the fact that the periods don't match in Schwarzschild De Sitter is very, very welcome. And third, that this process of thermal decay of the cosmological constant, as we will see next time, not only makes the cosmological constant to lower its value, but at the same time, as a bonus, it produces localized matter in the form of black holes. So it transmutes the cosmological term into black holes. And third, since these are membranes which contract coming from the cosmological horizon in, the expansion of the universe doesn't hurt, but it helps, because the thing is going against the traffic. You see that? And I hope to be able to elaborate clearly on the technical parts of this in the next lecture. So I finished on time, I think.
You wanted to make a strong relation between thermal physics and quantum physics or tunneling. But what one also have to say is that there are big differences. I mean, if you have a sphaleron, it doesn't contain time. It's just the unstable classical state. Whereas if you have an instanton, you have tunneling, there is still time. Of course, if you apply Langer's theory, some way you introduce time. Yes, so just normal mechanics, and you have unstable direction. You also talk about time, but still these are two different things, and it's still a question: what is stronger, the quantum mechanical tunneling or temperature effects? Hmm?
Well, I don't really know what to add to what I just said. To me, it's, of course, one modest instance of the deep interplay between quantum mechanics, thermodynamics, and gravity. The most famous example is the Bekenstein-Hawking formula for the entropy, but I think this is just a modest example of the same. That's all I can say, but it's fun to see it happening. No, it's not a formal similarity. I mean, you just calculate it. You calculate it. You go into the room, and you are only allowed to use thermodynamics and this Langer theory. You come up with an answer for the transition rate. You go into another room, and there is all these guys. There is Coleman and David Gross and all standing upon you. And they force you to do their way, and you come up with the same answer. That's what I find very nice.
One question is just similar to previous one, but what about entropy? Maybe you have A second question is something, this relation beta h equal 2 pi over omega is, it's sort of universal relation. I mean, what you were saying before, is this strange interplay between temperature and quantum mechanics. I mean, can be assumed this relation sort of universal relation?
No, no, I don't think it's universal. It so happens that, and we will see in hopefully in the next lecture that this is not so. And in general, there are, I mean, that equality sort of marks a threshold above which the thermalon dominates and below which the instanton dominates. I'm just repeating the lore. It so happens that in this 1+1 problem, since the problem is so limited, I mean, and there is so little room for movement, there is only one configuration in each regime, and not surprisingly maybe, it's just at the boundary between the two regimes because each regime has only one point. But it was fun to verify. But I don't think it's universal. That, and as we will see in the 3+1 case, the instantons are somewhere in configuration space and the thermalons are different. They're not related by a change of coordinates. This is just an accident of 1+1. So I should really have underlined that.
More questions, anyone?
Three plus one.
Oh, it's very, thank you. It's very much the same because in 3+1, the analog of the pair is a two-dimensional surface.
No, no, no. I
oh, what was the question then?
If I have genuine particles.
Oh, I see.
Genuine particles in three dimensions.
No, but I can hear you, that's fine. That's very hard. Yes, but there are so many directions. That's, yes, of course. No, no, I... yes, it does reduce the field. I'm just trying to be honest here. I don't know if we like to look at surfaces because... Oh, yes, no, it reduces the field, but the whole point is that then the contribution of the field is not a uniform energy density. That's I think, the difference.
More questions? So let's thank the speaker again. So we meet again at 5 p.m. after the coffee break.
Esse corpo moreno, cheiroso e gostoso que você tem é um corpo delgado da cor do peixe.